Major Hogan, Reel 1, please could you tell me where you were born and something about your family background?
I was born in Rangoon, Burma, 24th July 1923. My father was an assistant in the shipping department of Messrs. Steele Brothers and Company, an international company dealing in timber, rice, shipping, oil, you name it. I attended St. Philip's Junior School, which was a church school, till I was age 13, and then I went on to Big School, which was a cathedral school in Rangoon, the Diocesan Boys High School. When in high school, on the 15th of August 1939, I joined the Burma Auxiliary Force.
Why did you decide to do that?
To save enough money to buy myself a made-to-measure dinner jacket. All my friends who were fairly wealthy had made-to-measure dinner jackets. It's absolutely true. I had been rejected for the Merchant Navy because of my eyesight, so the next best thing was to become a soldier.
Can you tell me the type of things that you did in the unit?
I started off by joining the machine gun section of the Rangoon Battalion. Enjoyed every minute of it. Attended weekend range and weekend camps, annual camps. And I enjoyed the comradeship. And when war was declared in November 1939, we were embodied and did internal security duties at the Rangoon Electric Tramway Company, reservoirs, supply depots, dockyards, railway sidings.
Can you tell me what the attitude of the Burmese civilians was towards the war and towards the British presence at that time?
At that time, 90% anti-British. They wanted the British out. They always wanted the British out since 1937, when they got independence from India. And, of course, things got worse and worse. And during the campaign and the retreat, they were very naughty and waylaid and butchered quite a few British troops who had broken away from their main units.
Why were they so against the British presence, do you think?
The nationalists, they just wanted independence, and they total independence from Britain. And that's just, being a non-political animal myself, I couldn't answer that, and being too young. But that's basically what it is, what I read about after the war. They wanted independence from Britain. India had got independence, but within the Commonwealth in 1930. Now, they broke away from India in 1937, but they wanted complete independence from everybody, which they have now.
What type of Burmese were in favor of the British presence, then?
The Karens, that's myself, the Kachins up in the north, the Shans in the east, and the Chins in the west. In other words, the ethnic races.
The non-Burmese.
Non-Burmese races surrounding the delta and the valley, Mandalay southwards.
Why was it that the non-Burmese favoured the British presence?
I can only speak for the Karens. Karens and Burmese have always been at each other's throats, maybe for the last 200 years. And the Burma Army pre-war consisted 50%, this is approximation, of Karens. Although I say it myself, we were always loyal and trustworthy. I shouldn't use the word trustworthy, but we were always loyal to the British, and still are. and still on the borders there, fighting against the Burmese government. What else?
What was your own attitude when you heard that Britain had declared war on Germany? What did you feel?
My honest answer?
Yes.
Happy. Because I didn't want to go and do any further studies. I'm sorry, that's my answer. I was so happy that I won't have to go to university and study anymore. And I got into this soldiering as an auxiliary force, and I was dead keen then.
Why didn't you want to go to the university?
My mother wanted me to read a science subject, which I was no good in. She wanted me to do science and mechanical engineering. That's right, not civil engineering, mechanical engineering. And I had no interest in that. I always wanted to be in the forces of sorts. Started off with the Merchant Navy, and now I was in the auxiliary force. Although I say it myself, I was dead keen.
When you were on those internal security duties in 1939, did you have very much to do? Was there any danger from anybody who wanted to sabotage them?
No, I didn't see any, no. It was just boring 2 hours on, 4 hours off sentry duty as a private soldier. No, I didn't see anything whatsoever.
What happened in that period between September and up to you, between that September 1939 and the outbreak of the Pacific War?
I don't quite get that. I was still in high school and university, first year in university, and in between, if we were required, we were embodied for a week at a time or a fortnight at a time to do these various duties, internal security duty, guard duties. Otherwise, we carried on as normal as we could be, attending classes at university and then doing your internal security duty together.
So, but was it just like peacetime conditions in Burma?
Yes.
In 1941?
Yes, plenty of dancing and more British troops were coming in. Being a private, I didn't sort of take any much notice of this, but battalions were arriving, reinforcements. There were more parties and more Gloucesters and Duke of Wellington, the various regiments arrived. And now, as far as we were concerned, there was no war. And everybody was going to say, the war's going to be over, the war will be over next month, next 2 months. In Germany, I'm talking about. So it didn't affect us one bit.
Before the Japanese attacked in December 1941, did you personally think of the Japanese as a threat?
No.
Were there any Japanese civilians in...
Thousands. There were dentists, cameramen, roaming priests with their cameras clicking away. People then said that watch Japan, but we, as schoolboys at the time, thought it was with regard to manufacturing and industry, as opposed to an invasion as such.
You thought they were industrial spies?
More or less, yes. I wouldn't use that word at the time, because I was only 16 or 17 at the time. But they were doing something, and that eventually they would come into Burma in force and take over our timber and rice mills as opposed to attacking us.
I think that you told me earlier that you lied about your age.
Yes.
To get into the army.
I was born in 23, and in 1939 I was only 16. You had to be 18 to join the auxiliary force. So I pinched my brother's birth certificate and he was born in February 1922, which just about made me qualify for the age. And there was a Staff Sergeant Leopard there from the Royal Armoured Corps who looked at me, looked at the certificate, because he had seen me the week before, and he says, get in line and we'll take you on because you're so damn keen. And after the war I went to see him. He was still a Sergeant Major now, and I rolled up as a young captain. And he jumped up, saluted me, says, I always knew you'd make it, son. He says, you were a good young private. And I had kept a bottle of whiskey for him. That's why he liked it. he was huge with a blackberry. Lovely man.
So were you registered under your brother's name?
He didn't even look at it. I showed him the date of birth and, you know, took it away. And then he knew. He did. Get out of it and get in line, he says, we'll take you on. And I went there, and yes, my birthday is 19th of February 1921 instead of 24th July 1923. I tried to rectify that many times, and go to the adjutant, and he said, hey, get out of this, there's a war on, besides I don't know what to do. And when I became assistant adjutant of the 2nd Battalion of the Burma Rifles, I got my file out, and I didn't know what to do to rectify your age again. What do you do? So I just left it there.
What do you remember personally of the Japanese attack when it actually came at the end of 1941?
I was at annual camp at the beginning of December 41 at the Mingledoon Aerodrome. I was now in the armored car section, and we were doing perimeter patrols. I'm not quite sure, I think it was 23rd or 24th December, Christmas Eve, when they bombed us. Not very big bombs, but hell of a big bangs, you know, being the first time. And we were in the woods, hiding in camouflage in the woods on the perimeter of the aerodrome. But they seemed to know exactly where we were, and we got the brunt of it. And strangely enough, no one was killed, but our so-called armored cars I think two out of the four had holes through them. I then more or less witness Rangoon being drained of all the civilian population, because they had to walk past Mingledoon. Mingledoon was north of Rangoon, 12 miles north of Rangoon, and all the civilians, mostly Indians, by the way, in Rangoon, evacuating past the aerodrome. You could literally see them, thousands upon thousands, with bullock carts and rickshaws and carrying their whole households on their head. Then, of course, going into Rangoon, my mother and sister were still there. Ghost town. No bus services. Lights in some places, no lights. They say they had released the prisoners from Rangoon jail. And there was a rumor that they had released all the wild animals as well. So people were really dead scared. And then my mother and sister decided to go up north to try and get to India. So I had no more need to go back into Rangoon. But shortly after that, I think it was the end of January, the armored car section was ordered to go down to south of Burma on the road to Martaban and Moulmein. And on the 19th of February, I remember this date because it's my brother's birthday and it's supposed to be now my birthday, we were ambushed 8 or 9 miles north of Martaban. Came around the bend, there was a tree felled on the culvert there. And I was the second car. The leading car just about managed to stop and touch the barrier, because these armored cars, their brakes were very, very primitive. You had to use a crash gear, handbrake, leg brake, everything to stop it. And it just about touched it. And as we came around, the Thai soldiers, who we found out later, they were not Japs, they were Thai soldiers forced by the Japs to fight for them or to cause roadblocks, were literally sitting under the tree watching us come round. So when the first armored car very nearly knocked the tree, they both stood up. Ha! So we shot them. So amazed that we had come round the bend. So we opened up with our machine guns and thing, and they in turn opened up. Believe me, bullets, they were using 2-2 armor-piercing bullets. They came right through the car. Every one of us was wounded, either in us nicked here, nicked here, legs, shoulders. I got in the right thigh because I had the door open. We were driving along, not expecting to be ambushed, because the war was the other side of the bay in Moulmein, 12 miles away. This must have come round. They must have sent these young Thais, a platoon of them, I don't know how many, there were quite a few there. And our armored cars was from the First World War vintage. These bullets just came right through. And they also, where the turret meets the body of the car, there should have been an armor plating guard, but there wasn't one, so the bullets hit the thing, so we couldn't revolve the turret after a time. The bullets must have hit indentations in the grooves there, and we couldn't move the turret. However, we backed out of this, and they didn't follow up. About 500 yards away, we were out of sight. We turned the cars and went back to Tatone, where we were, where headquarters was stationed. We then fought a rearguard action all the way to Satang Bridge. We were always there because of the armored cars could be used as fixed lines of fire, static. We were bombed by the RAF, Blenheim bombers, I think, in spite of us standing in the middle of the paddy fields waving out to them. It came the first time, the second time, the third time. And then we got to Satang Bridge. Slept a night there, reorganized, dug slit trenches at the foot of the bridge. And the next morning, all hell broke loose because the Japs had infiltrated, as they usually do, up to Pongji Chaun. Pongji Chaun is a settlement around the pagoda, for want of a better word. And they came down this hill straight at us, and we opened fire, stopped them. And I must tell you, at this Pongji Chaun, a good friend of mine, George Hyde, who was also a private soldier, he took command when we were thinking of running back to the bridge and crossing. I remember so well, he stopped. "Hey, come on, use your guns." And all of us turned around, and we had those old 4-5 pistols, being an armored car unit. And that hit a man in the chest, and he really stops them. And then we all, "Oh, this is good." And we all jumped back into our trenches and kept these Japs at bay. And they went back up the hill.
Who's in charge of your unit?
In charge of our unit at that time was a Captain Keith Lorry. He had gone over the back to the North Bank, yes, the North Bank, to get orders from headquarters about what we were to do. Remember, in those days there was no telephone, nothing, not modern communication, and there was chaos there. And so he had gone across. The other officer who was observed was Lieutenant Shaw Hamilton, had been wounded and taken back to Mandalay. Now, I think you can find out from the books the date, actual date,
yes.
And the time. I think it was 4 o'clock in the morning. I know I was on sentry duty in the slit trench at the time, and half asleep, wondering whether the Japs would attack us next morning, because in those days you acted, you know, first light and dawn and dusk. And when this terrific crackle, till today I can remember that tearing of steel, and the Satang Bridge was blown. And if ever one could feel lost, devastated, it was then. And amazingly, I thought, where's I going to get my next meal from? Because the meals were being brought across the bridge from the North Bank to the South Bank by trucks, billy cans of tea and the old bread and corned beef. Amazing. I thought, where am I get my next meal from? Chaos reigned that whole day. The Japs came down the hill, down, and on our right was the Gurkha battalion. I think it was the 7th Gurkhas, commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Len Tain. We came under his command, and the next 3 or 4 days was absolute chaos. Who, what, why, when was food coming? Of course, being a private soldier, communications and all were no interest of mine. All we could think about was how much more ammunition, where can we get more ammunition to stay where we were, because on the bend of the road, we were right on the bend of the road where this Pungji Chowan came down, everywhere, but on our right was the safety. And of course the Japs had high ground, so they were just lobbing mortars and 2-inch mortars and 3-inch mortars at us. Nothing, you couldn't stop them. But the Gurkha battalion, I know, were being sent out, and we were silencing quite a few of these positions. But after that, 3 or 4, I really don't know what happened. I can't even think who was commanding our section at the time. But we followed the river. The Satang is a tidal bore, and according to the villagers, it could come down 12 to 20 feet high and take everything with it. And this happens depending on the moon. Anyway, the villagers suggested that we, and we had quite a lot of Gurkhas with us, and a motley branch, anybody came up going, because the Gurkha officers took command of everything. And we went, must have gone about 2 miles up the Satang River, because according to the villagers, a good swimmer would come out near the bridge somewhere. Because after the bridge, it starts getting into the open sea. So whether we went 2 miles or 3 miles, I don't know. But we started making rafts for the poor Gurkhas. They were non-swimmers, remember, a hill tribe. And at that time, it wasn't compulsory to know how to swim. We tried to make rafts out of the bamboo, whatever timber we could get. These big earthenware jars which the villagers had and stored their rice and water and various things. We bought some of those with whatever cash we want and turned them inside out to catch the air. But once they went in the water, they got slippery. These poor old Gurkhas couldn't grip, and they were just slipping into the water. Anyway, I think parties of about 30 or 40 were organized to swim this river. And I was in one of these parties, and coming down in a swift-flowing river. Have you been in one? It's frightening. You look at water, it's so beautiful. And once you get there, the top is underneath. It's frightening. Boots around my neck, a 4-5 pistol with its web belt, the big broad web belts. Joking here. Tin hat, which I lost immediately I got into the water, a pair of shorts, and that's it. About halfway, three-quarter way across, I had a thud in my thigh, and I thought, oh, God, there goes another poor Gurkha drowning. But it turned out that I was hit by shrapnel in my thigh. Having got to the north bank, about 300 yards from the bridge, climbed up, out of our party of about 30 or 40, I'm not quite sure, there must have been only about 10 of us left. And then we made for the railway line, which takes us to Pigu.
Yes, I can imagine how.
Yeah, you can, you know. And walked along the railway track, which is not very pleasant. Walking along, because the sleepers are not, you think it's even, but they're not. You've got to keep on looking. And if you walk to the side, it was shingle and sharp stone. And we got to Pigu, which was about a 42-mile walk. I think we did that in 2 days. And there was a hospital train where I had my shrapnel removed. Just by being pulled out, leaving a few bits inside, and dressed.
Who did that for you?
Believe it or not, two girls from Burma, two nurses, Sister Van Wyk. She wasn't a sister then, Nurse Van Wyk and Nurse Esme Sawyer. But about 10 minutes later, Colonel Barthaw, I remember his name very well, Colonel B-A-T-H-A-W, Colonel Doctor Barthaw, came down. Only seriously wounded would be taken in this train, no walking wounded. I was considered walking wounded, and the girls tried to hide me under their bunk, these two girls, but I couldn't fit under it because it was too low. I couldn't get under it. Anyway, I got...